Hello, and welcome to episode 20 of the Quiet Mark podcast. 20, what a milestone. We're really over the moon to have reached this point, and over the moon is a good place to be on this episode because today we're going to be talking about the sound of the stars. I'm your host, Simon Gosling, CMO at Quiet Mark. And Quiet Mark is the independent global certification program associated with the UK Noise Abatement Society Charitable Foundation. Through scientific testing and assessment, QuietMark identifies the quietest products in multiple categories spanning many sectors, including home appliances and technology, building sector materials, and commercial sector products. When you visit QuietMark.com, the first thing that you see on our homepage is a beautiful home with a glowing interior light, and outside it's nighttime and is a beautiful star field, such is our love for the beauty and the mystery of stars. But why are we talking about the sound of stars on this episode in particular? Well, it's early April 2021 as we release this episode, and from the 5th to the 12th of April, it's International Dark Sky Week, a time to discover the night. Every year, the International Dark Sky Association hosts International Dark Sky Week to raise awareness about light pollution's many negative effects. It's always been held when the sky is at its darkest and the stars are most visible. This annual event was created in 2003 by then high school student Jennifer Barlow. Since then, International Dark Sky Week has grown to become a worldwide event and a key component of Global Astronomy Month. During the week, dark sky defenders worldwide connect over a shared goal to protect the night. And on their website, darksky.org, everyone is invited to join in International Dark Sky Week 2021. Whether you're an International Dark Sky place, chapter, delegate, supporter, or a casual follower, there'll be many ways to engage and participate. Our guests on this episode are both members of the International Dark Sky Association. Paul Gregory is an IDA Technical Committee member, and we know him here at QuietMark because he's also Dyson's Global Specification and Training Director. And Paul is accompanied by fellow IDA member and Executive Director of Imagination Lancaster, Nick Dunn, who is Professor of Urban Design at Lancaster University. How's that for a job title, Director of Imagination? Well, Nick is also an author, and he's written a book called Dark Matters, A Manifesto for the Nocturnal City. The first review for which on Amazon gets 5 stars, saying, "This book was really beautifully written and has the ability to allow you to escape into the world it describes. Some really insightful moments and ideas, like a fascinating conversation." Well, that review pretty much describes the conversation that you're about to hear that I enjoyed with Nick and Paul just last month. I'm delighted to be sharing it with you. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the show, Paul and Nick.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Simon.
And where are you both today? I know you're both apart from one another. Where are you first, Paul?
I'm based at home in Oxfordshire. I'm on the Oxford-Warwickshire borders, just in a very northeast corner of the Cotswolds.
Good for star watching?
It's a fairly dark site here. Yeah, not truly dark, but pretty dark, yeah.
And how does that compare to where you are, Nick? Tell us where you are.
Well, no real dark skies here, I'm afraid, Simon. I'm talking to you from South Manchester, where I'm sat in my studio at the bottom of the garden.
Oh, well, thank you both for joining us today. And before we talk about International Dark Sky Association and International Dark Sky Week, which is taking place from the 5th to the 12th of April, I'd like to know your journey towards that. So tell us about your day jobs, who you are, and what you do in your daily life. If I can start with you again, please, Paul.
Yeah, so day job is I'm the Global Specification and Training Director for Dyson. That's quite a mouthful, I know that. Head up a team of people that look after specification within Dyson and then also the global training. And my night job, if you like, is with the IDA. I'm part of the IDA Technical Committee, so I'm a member of the Technical Committee, and we advise the board of the IDA on policies and technical issues and emerging issues for outdoor lighting practice.
And how about you, Nick? What keeps your daytime and your nighttime busy?
Well, during the day, I'm lucky enough to have perhaps one of the best job titles in the world, Simon. It's Executive Director of Imagination. And that's the Design and Architecture Research Lab at Lancaster University, where I'm also Professor of Urban Design.
I love
that. During the night, I go out on night walks, I explore urban environments, and I'm really trying to better understand how we can have more positive engagements with darkness and perhaps rethink the relationship that we have with so much artificial light.
Now, you're so passionate about this, Nick, you've written a book called Dark Matters, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I wrote a book a few years ago, Dark Matters, A Manifesto for the Nocturnal City. And I was really thinking through the poetics of being out in places at night and how they really stimulate all our different senses, our smell, our perhaps lack of vision, the experiences, the tactile qualities of being in urban places after dark, and what that might mean for us in terms of our imagination and creativity. You know, how can we rethink our design values for the nocturnal city?
Amazing. You talk about how we can unlock certain vision. I recall that Wayne's World sketch in the 1992 film where Wayne and Garth, they're on the bonnet of the car. We see this scene, not just in Wayne's World, but in so many films where, you know, teenagers, bonnets of cars, and they're looking up romantically at these starry night skies. And there seems to be something about that which enables you to sort of open up and share your dreams and have conversations which you certainly wouldn't have down the pub. There's a romance to it. Why is that?
I think there's something very profound about dark skies. I mean, dark skies are a realm in themselves, but they also overlap the aesthetic, the scientific, and I guess even the spiritual. I mean, let's not forget, we ourselves are made of stars. Nearly all the elements in the human body were a star at some point. And that's also the case for Earth and all the other life forms we share it with. So it's perhaps not surprising when we experience a starry-filled dark sky, we are reconnecting with who we are, but we're actually awestruck. You know, dark skies are literally awesome. And I think that's very much about how we have a relationship with them. When we experience them with someone else, you're absolutely right. You know, that connection between us, that ability to talk and perhaps open up ourselves a little bit and say things that we might not normally say where we sat facing each other in a cafe or a pub, becomes quite a different experience, you know, quite a beautiful, humbling experience sometimes, and very personal.
Has it opened up the romantic nature in you, Paul?
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, the that wonder, that awesomeness that you experience when you're under a truly sort of dark sky, I think absolutely should be encouraged, and we should get more young people out there definitely to experience that. I've got a teenage son who's constantly sort of gaming in his room, but, you know, I not forcibly, but certainly make him come outside with me and really sort of get him unplugged. And, you know, one of the stats I read recently was that 30 years ago, you know, nearly 70% of children or young adults under the age of 16 had spent at least one night outside camping. Now that's less than 20%. And it's really, really important, that sort of connection with nature, the fresh air, the relationship that we spoke about, the stress relief of actually being outside and sleeping outside as well, under the sort of nature and stars, and really just that unplugging that we talked about previously.
Yes, you know, I was reading something before we did this meeting today, and it was saying the Milky Way is no longer visible to more than one third of the world's population. Light pollution is increasing worldwide at twice the rate of global population growth. People living near Paris would have to travel 900 kilometers to areas such as central Scotland, Corsica, or central Spain to find a region with night skies almost unpolluted by light. Can that be right, 900 kilometers?
Yeah, I think it is. Actually, there's an interesting story. When the LA blackouts happened in 1994, the city completely no light whatsoever. And there were thousands of calls to 911 saying that the city was on fire and that there was a plume of smoke rising above Los Angeles. And of course, what they were experiencing was the Milky Way and that very sort of milky sort of look to our own galaxy. But it's actually less than 10% of our global population that has seen the Milky Way. So whilst others might have access to it, less than 10% have actually seen it.
Goodness.
Yeah, well, I think that point that Paul's raised, you know, with that example, it's, you know, people literally don't know what we're missing. The majority of the world's population have no idea how the cost of light, you know, how efficiency has got us into a situation where we use so much artificial lighting without really questioning how we do so and why.
On this podcast, we've talked a lot about noise pollution, sound pollution, and one of the things we discuss is the fact that during the first lockdown, there was a wave of silence that spread over the planet. The volume of the planet decreased by 50%, seismometers showed us, and they said that this was due to the fact that man-made noise wasn't being generated. Can the same be said of light pollution?
I'm afraid it can't, Simon. During the first lockdown, I went on quite a number of walks at nighttime through Manchester and the greater region as part of my ongoing research into cities at night. And the second lockdown and the current lockdown that we find ourselves. And whilst it was quite incredible to hear new sounds to me for the night, you know, how does the night sound, that bird song, without the traffic noise, without the hubbub of a 24-hour busy place such as the city of Manchester, the lights are still blazing, but for no one, you know, bar the odd street cleaner and person, no one about, no one around. And this is quite troubling, I think, because when we see lots of water gushing out of damaged pipes and drains in our towns and cities, we can become concerned. We'd be even more alarmed if we regularly smelt gas leaking out of buildings and streets as we move through the built environment. So why don't we feel the same about light pollution?
Yeah, I completely get that. And I've seen it myself, obviously. I'm fortunate enough to live further out of a town, and actually did see, because I'm an avid amateur astronomer, and the stargazing was better of the stars that I could see. It was like almost turning on a bit of high definition, if you know what I mean, in terms of just the level of pollution that was obviously in our upper atmosphere that was no longer there during lockdown. And it was interesting, Nick mentioned there about, you know, hearing bird song. And it's just, you know, this isn't just about, you know, geeks like me that like looking at the stars and things like that. Light pollution really affects our wildlife and our ecosystems, and particularly birds and bats. So there's a real environmental consideration here, not just the wasting energy bit that we've already sort of touched on, but real issues with our wildlife as well. I mean, there's an awful case recently, actually, about some fledgling birds in New Zealand. And these birds actually fledge during a full moon. And literally what they do is they leave their nest, cliffside sort of nest, fly out to the ocean. And the reason they fledge in a full moon is that the full moon will pick up the iridescent scales on the back of fish. So they then dive down and feed. Now, unfortunately, in this instance in New Zealand, they decided to put in a load of LED streetlights. And unfortunately, 4,500 birds fledged and then hit the road. Because the newly installed LED lights were picking up pieces of glass and other reflectance in the road surface, but thankfully, as they do in New Zealand, they just switched the lights off immediately and then investigated. So I wish we could be a bit more like New Zealand, actually, and flick the lights off whenever we discover a problem.
With the International Dark Skies Association, is there a lobbying element to, you know, what you're saying there, Nick, about light? Sound pollution's come down 50%, light hasn't. Someone's got to be doing something about this. And is that what the International Dark Skies Association is doing?
Yes, it is. It's part of the vision and the remit of the IDA is to advocate, improve public understanding, but also have sometimes those political entanglements to encourage policy to change. And that's why in the UK, we're pleased to say they've started up the all-parliamentary party group for dark skies with 10 recommendations about how we might consider dark places and our relationship with light pollution in the UK.
I know you're an expert in artificial intelligence. Surely it must be possible for shop windows or streetlights to only light up when people are in the area, or the technology must exist to be able to turn the lights off when they're not needed, surely.
We do have the technology. We could have all kind of nuanced relationships with light in darker places at night. The big obstacle for a lot of us really is a human one, and it's to do with cultural associations of light and dark, And it's to do with our perceptions of it in terms of concerns about safety, in terms of how we feel, in terms of comfort, and all these other things that are quite deeply ingrained in us. You know, this goes back way into history. You know, I mean, darkness was humankind's first primary kind of evil, if you like. It was the thing that was really of concern to people. So as lighting technologies developed, we tended to get more and more of them. But that wasn't always the case. You don't have to go that far back in history, only 150 years, and you'll find that people in London and Paris were smashing the street lamps because they put light perhaps on activities that they did not want to be lit up, and they didn't enjoy suddenly having these things cast in light.
Almost sounds like a reaction to CCTV cameras going on there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is in some ways. You know, I mean, the difference is that in the UK at the time, in London, if you were to do that, you know, you'd get a warning and a fine. I'm afraid in France, because you were effectively attacking the kingdom, the punishment was somewhat more severe. So it was the guillotine.
Off with their head. Good position for stargazing, though, from a basket.
That history and heritage actually does run through. I mean, we would never have really learned about our expanding universe if we weren't looking at the night sky, you know, hundreds of years ago. We wouldn't have navigated the globe by stars. And I love the picture of Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night in Saint-Rémy in France, which he painted in 1889. And a beautifully painted picture with lots and lots of stars in the sky. If you look at that Saint-Rémy church now, you can't see one star in the sky. So you can imagine how our artists were inspired by that, and our astronomers were inspired by that, you know, in the fairly recent past.
Goodness, so you're saying a modern day artist, whether using a camera or a brush, would not be able to get that image in Saint-Rémy?
No, absolutely.
That's crazy. Nick, you were talking about night walks and you're a lecturer with young students. On a previous show, we had a guest, Dr. Marcia Jenneth Epstein, and she's a lecturer at Calgary University. And she's been recommending to her students that they go on sound walks. Now, the principle of sound walks is to go on a walk without a device. No headphones, no earbuds, no phone. Just go out for a walk, listen to nature, and see what happens. And almost like a book club, when you finish reading a book, you regather with your friends and then you talk about what you got from the book. They do this about the sound walk. They say, I heard these sounds, this is how it made me feel, and it's a shared experience. Is night walking something that you do with your students? And also, what role does your fascination with stars play in your teaching?
Great question. I mean, yes, I do work with the students, and sometimes we've been out on night walks. I'm very keen to engage all different types of groups and communities in collective night walks. I recognize that the history of night walking has often been gendered and racialized. It's often white privileged men that have been able to walk through the night, particularly the urban night, without consequence. And that's not the same for other people in different forms of society throughout history. So helping people feel more confident about being out at night in urban environments, enabling people to have positive engagements with darkness in urban places is really part of that. I guess it is similar to a sound walk in the way that you're describing. But what's fascinating about going out at night is that you actually have a multi-sensory experience of the place. You become acutely aware of the texture underneath the feet as you're walking along, you know, the smells, the sounds, maybe even the tastes of what is happening in your environment, because the reliability of your vision is not as good as it is in the daytime. So very keen to promote that. And people often, you know, will say, students and members of the public, I would never have done that on my own, but now that I have, I will definitely do this again. They found it really quite an enriching experience. In terms of the night sky, the research that I'm doing and the work that I'm doing in some of my teaching, particularly with postgraduate students, is really about exploring the impacts of nocturnal activity on humans and other species. That's why we're establishing the Dark Design Lab at Lancaster University, with the aim of reducing the environmental impact of urban places at night. So that's my role in the IDA. I'm bridging across academia and multiple design professions to try and promote these positive engagements and really get people to think differently about light pollution and darkness. They're two sides of the same coin in many ways.
Tell us more about that lab.
Okay, well, we're in the process of setting it up, so I'm afraid you can't visit just today, not quite yet. So what we're doing with the Dark Design Lab is exploring the impacts of nocturnal activity on humans and other species. And we're setting up a fully immersive environment that allows us to explore the impact of different arrangements of light and darkness, different types, with someone sat in that space, or maybe peoples sat in that space, to measure the effects, to see what they can do, and also record their perceptions of it. We're inspired by bioluminescence, things that naturally occur in jellyfish, in plankton. I mean, plankton is really interesting in how it can be stimulated, because when you move the water, it glows temporarily and then it dissipates again. We could recreate that for the urban night. We could have a much more subtle, atmospheric and rich set of nocturnal design values for our urban environments than we do at the moment. It's not a one size fits all, or ever-increasing brightness. But I'm sure Paul would have something to say about this as well from a technical point of view.
Yeah, and you know, most lighting manufacturers actually, and we touched on it earlier, that light pollution is something we can fix very quickly with the flick of a switch. And, you know, the answer to light pollution is also in the catalogues of most of the lighting manufacturers. And those reputable lighting manufacturers are actually starting to look how they can do something different, how they can control light pollution a bit more. And the IDA have recognized that one of the best ways that we can accomplish our goal in protecting and restoring our natural night environment is through the promotion of quality outdoor lighting. And I don't think many people actually realize how bad for you some of the lighting is. And I think, Nick, you know that yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're not really considering here, Simon, is the choices we make. When we maybe go to a home store, a DIY store, and we make a purchase of a bulb, the price difference between a much brighter light source and one that we already pick up, think, okay, that's worth the extra pound or so. We should definitely invest in that. But the impact of that is not clear. We spoke earlier, you know, about the effects on biodiversity and other species. LEDs can have huge impacts on sleep and circadian rhythms of human beings. It is literally bad for us as well. Let's not forget that. You know, this is not just about other species. We belong to the world too, and we're part of that situation. Whether we'll see health warnings with light sources, that could be interesting in the way that we market cigarettes at the moment. Mm. I mean, can you imagine, you know, you're approaching your home stores and these being hid behind a sliding door and you're having to ask for a particular specification. I don't know that we'll get there. But on a serious note, I believe the young generations, you know, the young people are going to follow us. They're going to look back on some of the things we're doing now and really question it. You know, they'll wonder about all the perverse time we spend doing emails, and they'll think, what were those people doing with all that light everywhere?
You talked about sleep being affected, and we know that when your sleep is affected, the short-term effects are irritability and certain anxiety, but the long-term effects of lack of sleep can be type 2 diabetes, types of cancer. So it's not so much the light necessarily, but if the light is keeping you awake and you're not sleeping, light pollution is a very, very bad thing.
Yeah, the lighting industry have done a number of studies on what we call melanopic lux. So the very high blue light content that, again, actually is pretty invisible. It's picked up by a cell in the eye. And this particular wavelength of light actually controls the release of melatonin, our sleep hormone, if you like. And that's suppressed throughout the day. If you're working in an office, we tend to be sort of working in a box, living in a box, and then we go outside to a very light polluted city. So our body never actually, as Nick mentioned previously, never actually get the time to reset their circadian rhythm. And that causes a lot of those sleep problems. We shouldn't be living in cities where you have to have blackout blinds to be able to get to sleep at night, you know. And those blue LEDs, those very high color temperature LEDs that everybody's aware of, and, you know, there's nighttime mode on your phones and iPads now that did, you know, deliberately take down the blue light content. And that's since the discovery of this this melanopic stimulus that is preventing this release of melatonin. Now, you know, we know that sleep is absolutely the most fundamentally important thing that we can do, and you know, as humans, to recover. And and not only that, melatonin is actually known to eliminate free radicals in the body. And we know that free radicals, if left to continue, will go on to cause cell mutations, and cell mutations can go on to cause cancers. And, you know, there is absolutely a link, I think, with sleep deprivation, mental health issues, as well as physical health issues. Quiet
Now, on this show, we also spoke to a couple of companies that create apps that encourage sound walking. So, of course, as the host of the show, I have to do it. And I've continued with it. When we did an episode recently about sleep for Sleep Awareness Week, we were recommended to go to bed at 10 o'clock, have an hour between when we go to our bedrooms and maybe going to sleep. But I'm practicing what's being preached on the show. If I want to become a stargazer, how do I start?
So actually, there are a number of apps very similar to what you've described in terms of the sort of walks. But there's a number of apps that will allow you to find out where your nearest dark sky place is. There's an app called Meet Stargazers. I have to say, a lot of these apps are quite heavily US-centric at the moment. But the UK, outside of the US, has the largest number of international dark sky places than any other country. So look it up. There will be a dark sky place not too far from you, I would hope. And certainly if you're in London, there's the South Downs that has dark sky status. We have Snowdonia in Wales, Exmoor in the southwest. Further up with Nick, do you want to talk about some of the parks near you?
Of course, we've North Yorkshire Moors, we've also Northumberland, we've also Galloway, and then of course the northern part of Scotland. So there's lots of opportunities. And I would say to all your listeners, you know, at the moment, while perhaps many of us will be making decisions not to get on a plane or go anywhere, why do that when you could literally go and visit the cosmos this year?
Now, guys, we're all familiar with Starman by David Bowie, but what about the stars themselves? Do they sing? Do they make music? Do they make any sound at all? And can we hear it from good old planet Earth?
Well, actually, there is a study by NASA called Symphony of Stars and the Science of Stellar Sound Waves. And I've got an excerpt here, actually, by Elizabeth Landau, who's NASA's Planet Exploration Program. And she goes on to say that we can't hear it with our ears, but the stars in the sky are performing a concert, and one that never stops. The biggest stars make the lowest, deepest sounds, like tubas and double basses. Some small stars have high-pitched voices, like celestial flutes. And these virtuosos don't just play one note at a time. Our own sun has thousands of given sound waves bouncing around inside at any given moment. And understanding these stellar harmonies represent a revolution in astronomy. By listening for stellar sound waves with telescopes, scientists can actually figure out what stars are made of and how old they are, how big they are, and how they contribute to the evolution of our Milky Way. In International Dark Sky Week was formed so that all of the sort of dark sky advocates and clubs around the world could actually have a forum and a week where all of these events are publicized by the IDA. There are lots of stargazing events that happen throughout the year, and we've just finished a round of those, and I know Nick spoke at the Cumbria Dark Skies Festival, which happened recently. Friends of the Lake District also had a dark sky festival, and then there was one in the South Downs as well, also in February. But the IDSW, or International Dark Sky Week, is really the forum for promoting those events, getting together, sharing images of the dark skies that that everybody just make you terribly jealous when you see their see their dark skies, that's for sure.
So when did you first get into stargazing, Paul?
Probably like most people, it was quite accidental, really. We went on a week, my wife took me away on a weekend trip to Guernsey, and we got the opportunity to go to Sark and in the Channel Islands. And if anybody's had the opportunity to go to Sark or haven't been, you have to go. There is no streetlights. There is no traffic. There's one pub, so tick. And there's a few shops and some good restaurants and a couple of hotels as well. But Sark is actually the world's first recognized dark sky island. And I didn't know this at the time, and we were there, and I got to experience the Milky Way for the first time. And I can only say that this experience was, you know, we often use the word awesome and throw it away, but it truly was an awesome experience. And it was only when I left and I saw the plaque and it said IDA, International Dark Sky Island, that I came away from there and then bought a telescope. And every year I've upgraded that telescope and start looking more and more at the stars in our own universe.
How has this changed you?
I think what it does is and I think some of that experience was I just felt very insignificant, if I'm honest, and I'm sat there under our own universe and felt very insignificant. And I what it did for me, certainly in my professional career, was start to really think about actually what I'm doing and how ethical some of the, you know, and bearing in mind at this time I was working for a lighting manufacturer and still selling lights. And we have to be thinking as lighting manufacturers, as we were then, about that quality over quantity. Why chuck so many lights into a scheme that's not needed? And, you know, about lighting at the right time, the right place, and for the sort of right reasons as well. And it just made me think of that. Obviously, I went on to work for Dyson, and I think the health benefits and everything that we're doing to ourselves has really sort of, that's what's impacted my sort of career, really, starting to look at the implications and health benefits. And we've talked about air quality, we've talked about noise, and we've talked about light quality. And all of those things do have an effect on our human body.
Nick?
It's made me want to share even more. The dark skies are part of our shared heritage, the part of our history as beings on this planet. And it's completely reframed the way I think about the future, and also encouraged students and colleagues to reconsider our relationship with the planet. You know, so rather than design, for example, being based on human needs all the time, you know, human-centered design is very much where we find ourselves for our own whims and desires. Shifting that now to an ecology-centered design, thinking about the environment and ourselves as part of that process in a very real and tangible way. It's completely transformed my life in the most positive and profound way. And as you can probably tell from the way I'm talking about it now, I'm always keen to share that experience with others. Because once you do, you see, you know, them become encapsulated by the idea, excited, and then they often want to act and commit and engage with this as well. So it's a wonderful experience.
Do you think your students appreciate that?
They might not appreciate going out at 2 a.m. for a walk. yes, they really do. Because for a generation that are digital natives, that have always been attached to screens, that are completely connected in ways that I certainly wasn't in my childhood, I have literally opened up the universe to them. It's not obviously mine to open, but I've connected them to something that really has existed for them in retro TV series like Stranger Things, you know, these other dimensions, these other worlds, the realms of the stars. And now they're beginning to see themselves as a generation that can take forward the important things and the values about how we stay connected to the dark skies we have. You know, younger people are quite understandably calling the older generations to task. And quite rightly so. You know, we've not left the planet in a very good place. We've made some quite curious decisions over the last few decades. And now it's time to change. And they are the agents of change. They see themselves in that. And rather than individualizing the problem, their forms of collaboration, cooperation and connection are greater perhaps than ever we were able to do when we were younger, because they really do follow these things through. They are the advocates for our relationship with dark skies going forward. And you can see them energized and excited by that. You know, it's really, really rewarding.
Now, you've talked about Sark, but I always end the podcast with a fun question to my guests. And the obvious question in this podcast is, where were the stars that blew your mind and took your breath away? I'm going to go to you first with that one, Nick, and then come to you, Paul. So, Nick, where's the best starscape you've seen?
The best starscape I saw was on the South Downs, actually. I was traveling to friends in Brighton. I was due to get there and take advantage of the fact there wouldn't be too much traffic on the road. So I went in the middle of the night. As I was about to arrive in the early hours, I had to stop the car because I could see something phenomenal. You know, I was driving through this nighttime movie, and even with the headlights of the car, I could see these amazing things in the heavens. And so I moved over, I took a fair walk off actually into the South Downs Park, and saw the most mesmerizing thing. The memory will never leave me. It was absolutely incredible.
For me, one of the sort of things that really resonates with me is my young son and taking him out into the night sky. And we went to a local sort of tourist spot called the Rollright Stones. Think a miniature Stonehenge, very miniature Stonehenge.
Like Spinal Tap size.
Yes, Spinal Tap size miniature Stonehenge, but they're ancient monolithic stones, and the Rollright Stones has actually got a dark sky discovery site. But we went on the 31st of October, Halloween, right. And actually, what I pointed out to my son was the Pleiades. For those that aren't familiar with the Pleiades, they're in the northern hemisphere. And if you actually look at Orion's Belt, which are the three stars, yeah. Most people can identify Orion's Belt. If you look off to the angle of Orion's Belt, you'll see a little cluster of stars called the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters. And actually, ancient Druid, and it was relevant why we were at the Rollright Stones, but actually ancient Druid culture believed that when they were at their highest zenith in the sky at midnight on the 31st of October, that was when the veil came down between the living world and the dead. And the dead could cross over into the living world. Just seeing the look on my 13-year-old son's face as we stood there in the middle of darkness, nearing midnight on the 31st of October, was worth every stargazing
amazing.
Trip there ever has been.
Oh, that's really beautiful. Well, you know, you spoke about the way it made you feel in the universe, Paul. There was a time I was in the Alps with a team that I used to ride with called the Fireflies, and we were on a mountain, Turini. And we were cycling at night. It's a crazy thing to do. But that's where I probably saw the best stars that I've ever seen. And I actually saw fireflies darting around as well. Two things you see on quietmark.com, stars and fireflies. But no coincidence there. But thank you so much for giving us time today to raise awareness of International Dark Sky Week, to share your adventures with stars. And it's been a real pleasure chatting with you both. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you, Simon. It's been great. A genuine pleasure.
As I said in the programme, we know Paul from his work with Dyson. Dyson, of course, being one of the 80 brands whose products are QuietMark certified and available through quietmark.com. And it's great to know that the role of someone whose job it is to share and teach is in the hands of someone with Paul's sensitivity who takes so much from stars and how they enable him to reflect upon himself. A couple of years ago, I saw Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh in the MoMA Museum in New York. It was in a large room alongside other famous paintings such as Henri Rousseau's The Dream. So many people were queuing up to take a photograph of the Starry Night picture. They popped in, took their shot and left without so much as a glance as the other paintings in the room. But it's such a famous painting. And such a scene in the MoMA really goes to show our obsession not just with van Gogh, but also with the Starry Night. So famous is the painting, in fact, that Lego have created a Lego set of Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night, which we posted on our LinkedIn recently. The Lego set even comes with a Lego Vincent van Gogh standing at his easel. To find out more about the International Dark Sky Week, you can go to darksky.org, that's darksky.org, where you can sign up for updates, engage and participate. I found it interesting during that conversation to note how the power and the technology is in our hands to do something about light pollution and sound pollution. If we can change our behaviour, we can do something about the problem. Thank you for tuning into this episode, and do please stay tuned for future episodes. I'll be talking to Ping Coombs, MasterChef winner 2014, asking her what role does sound play in cooking. I've also just booked into the calendar an interview with Matthew Bennett, a composer, sound artist, and former director of sound and sensory design at Microsoft. As chief sound designer of the company, he created and shaped the sound of Microsoft's major products and platforms, Windows, Office, Outlook, Teams, Azure, Xbox, Surface, and more. His sounds are recognized around the world and heard billions of times a day by millions of people. So I'm really looking forward to having that conversation and to sharing it with you. Thanks for listening, stay tuned, and I'll see you for the next one. Bye for now.